Jim Barely of Jim Barely's famous monkey blog. You're of the blog generation of poets. You were a toddler when Robert Lowell died. I want you to read some of your Lowell, but for starters, who is Robert Lowell to you?
Well, Robert Lowell was the first poet I ever made any real connection to, or even...
Really?
I don't think I would be a poet without having read his work at the time that I read it.
Really?
I was up in Danvers, Massachusetts. I went to St. John's Prep up there in Danvers, Mass., and I was a troublemaker. And so instead of going home after school to beat on my little brother, in my junior year, my mother demanded that I walk to the Peabody Institute Library in Danvers and sit with her. She was a librarian there, the reference librarian. And she made sure that I would hang around until we would both go home together. So I was stuck on the third floor among the stacks. And that's when I first...
What punishment, man?
Well, it turned out pretty good. I fell in love with a page, and it was kind of fun to follow her around as she shelved books. But I think what really happened was I was interested in poetry, and I started to delve into these poets who were there. And mostly it was, at first I thought you couldn't really be a poet unless you killed yourself. So I was very interested in Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton and John Berryman especially. But they led me to Lowell, and they had so much at that library, and I'm grateful that I was able to go through so much of his stuff and just be amazed and enthralled and possessed.
Do you remember the first Lowell poem that said, "This is poetry, Jim Barely"?
It must have been Life Studies, that collection, because some of the things that came out of it, he talks about Beverly and Beverly Farms, places that I was familiar with. I think that's where he made real inroads with me. I might have started with Dolphin or one of the late books, but I think it was Life Studies that now even, I mean, still remains very important to me.
Read one of those poems, Jim, please.
Let's see here. There are so many little pieces of paper sticking out. This is this is about Beverly Farms. This is called Terminal Days at Beverly Farms.
About his father's death.
Yeah, and I mean, Beverly Farms had such a big meaning to me at the time. I used to ride my bike through. We were altar boys at St. Margaret's in Beverly Farms, and that was sort of a haven place to go and sort of to think about the. He talks about the railroad tracks, and that was something I was very familiar with there. Or going to West Beach. Terminal days at Beverly Farms. At Beverly Farms, a portly, uncomfortable boulder bulked in the garden center, an irregular Japanese touch. After his bourbon, old-fashioned father, bronzed, breezy, a shade too ruddy, swayed as if on deck duty under his six-pointed star lantern. Last July's birthday present, he smiled his oval Lowell smile. He wore his cream gabardine dinner jacket and an indigo cummerbund. His head was efficient and hairless. His newly dieted figure was vitally trim. Father and mother moved to Beverly Farms to be a 2-minute walk from the station, half an hour by train from the Boston doctors. They had no sea view, but sky blue tracks of the commuter's railroad shone like a double-barreled shotgun through the scarlet late August sumac, multiplying like cancer at their garden's border. Father had had two coronaries. He still treasured underhand economies, but his best friend was his little black Chevy, garaged like a sacrificial steer with gilded hooves, yet sensationally sober, and with less side than an old dancing pump. The local dealer, a buccaneer, had been bribed a king's ransom to quickly deliver a car without chrome. Each morning at 8:30, inattentive and beaming, loaded with his calc and trig books, his clipper ship statistics, and his ivory slide rule, Father stole off with the Chevy to loaf in the Maritime Museum at Salem. He called the curator the commander of the Swiss Navy. Father's death was abrupt and unprotesting. His vision was still 20/20. After a morning of anxious, repetitive smiling, his last words to Mother were, "I feel awful."
It's a beautiful line. It reminds me of that line, "My mind is not right."
Yeah.
You could bite off those quick, as you say, quotes.
It's really an effective way. It makes you really want to start, go back to the top of the poem. And many times, especially with this one, I would immediately go back to the top of the poem and read it again. Because at the end, he just takes your breath away. So many of the things in here, I mean, what I made connections to were things like Salem or the museum or the ocean or that idea. You know, I rode that train quite a bit, you know, coming into Boston. Things like this, I think, really spoke to me. And I said, well, there was a poet here. There was a poet who wandered around here. His father died here. It made me feel connected to a new world that was peopled with poets for the first time.
Read another.
Well, there's so many. He wrote quite a bit in history about other poets, and I found it fascinating. You know, I think when I became a poet, I imagined that I was joining the brightest ring of angels. And his portraits of these people are, you know, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes very cutting. And they drew me in to get a, you know, sense of these people. I was always a fan of John Berryman, who was, I know, his great friend. For John Berryman, one, I feel I know what you have worked through. You know what I have worked through. We are words, John. We use the language as if we made it. Luck threw up the coin, and the plot swallowed, monster yawning for its mess of pottage. Ah, privacy. As if we had preferred mounting some rock by a mossy stream and counting the sheep, to fame that renews the soul but not the heart. The outtide flings up wonders, rivers, linguini, beer cans, mussels, bloodstreams, how gaily they gallop to catch the ebb. Herbert, Thoreau, Pascal, born to die with the enlarged hearts of athletes at 40, Abraham sired with less expectancy, heaven his friend, the earth his follower. An untraditional sonnet, I mean, 14 lines in some meter, but where he's changing it or where he's going back, I mean, he's quite famous for revision and to the point of many different versions of the same poems over and over to get it right, such a perfectionist. Robert Frost is another. This one is from history as well. Robert Frost at midnight, the audience gone to vapor, the great act laid on the shelf in mothballs. His voice is musical and raw. He writes in the flyleaf, for Robert, from Robert, his friend in the art. Sometimes I feel too full of myself, I say, and he, misunderstanding. When I am low, I stray away. My son wasn't your kind. The night we told him Merrill Moore would come to treat him, he said, I'll kill him first. One of my daughters thought things. Thought every male she met was out to make her. The way she dressed, she couldn't make a whorehouse. And I, sometimes I'm so happy I can't stand myself. And he, when I am too full of joy, I think how little good my health did anyone near me. I think Lowell is sort of describing his disappointment. But also, I think it's the most human. He presents Frost as a troubled and human guy who just happened to write poems that we care about. It was very interesting to me that poets could say such things or write about such things or write about each other in sort of unflattering ways. I think Lowell was very interested in revealing almost anything that he thought he could reveal. And even these quiet moments that were between man to man end up being confessed in this way. That it's all something that he found he could work with.
I want another example of the kind of poem that made you want to be a poet.
I think what attracted me to Lowell in general was obviously his poetry is very muscular, and there's a lot of terrific sound going on, a lot of great meter. But also, as I was making connections to Boston in my own life, commuting in and as a youngster and going to Suffolk University, that you could almost point out the things that he was mentioning and talking about. He's very much a poet of Boston. I think about, you know, For the Union Dead, which is one of his most famous poems, and the relief that he's speaking of, you know, across Beacon Street was just around the corner from Suffolk. I think what attracted me then, and I've written, you know, quite a bit, and I especially then, poems that tried to capture Boston maybe in the same way. A Robert Lowell poem is the sound of an autumn day in Boston and a walk. The hard steps, but also the sort of, you know, the clean brush of leaves. I think he captures, I mean, quite often and at his best, that he's personifying this, you know, with his voice and with his lines. They sound so perfect. They sound so whistling at times.
Give us a favorite example of yours.
I'll read the last five stanzas of For the Union Dead, and I think you hear it building. This is a snowy day in Boston, and he's speaking of Colonel Shaw in his relief. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown and lost with his niggers. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here on Boylston Street. A commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of the Negro school children rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere giant finned cars nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on Greece. So much of the stuff I missed, the race relations in Boston and problems with busing and different things that Lowell sort of opened this world for me. I think what comes out of his command of words, I mean, he has it right when he's addressing Berryman in these poems and says, we controlled, you know, we are words. We can do anything we want with them. He was so much talent that I think what he chooses to do with them is so interesting. He's venting. He's letting off steam. He's being angry. He's doing all these things that I don't think I ever imagined a poet could do or would want to do or would want to do so well.
What is he doing at the end of that poem? And when he talks about waiting for the blessed break and the servility sliding by on Greece in those finned cars, what's that all about? Peter Davison was asking me, so who's servile and what does that refer to? To me, afterward, it seemed to be, it throws back to the noses of the cowed, compliant fish in the old aquarium.
I think he sees us and himself. He always seems to be implicating himself as well. That he sees Bostonians as being the sort of school that swims but doesn't look around and remember, waiting for the blessed break.
Meaning?
When will we stop swimming in the same direction? When will we stop and look at this colonel and his troops in a way that would reveal something, in a way that we would really come to understand it?
Is there one more poem that you can remember grabbing you as a kid or sort of instructing you or encouraging you in a big way?
I was very interested in love poems in general. I don't think that he ever came out and had such flowing love poems. They were always very complicated and fraught, it seems to me. This is another from history. This is called Red and Black Brick Boston. Life will not extend, though I'm in love. Light takes on meaning any afternoon now, 10 years from now or yesterday. The Arctic brightness bakes the red bricks black, a color too checkered to splash its happiness. The winter sun is shining on something worthy, begging the visible be eternal. Eternity isn't love or made for children. A man and a woman may meet in love, though married, and risk their souls to snatch a child's attention. I glow at the warmth of these soiled red bricks, their unalikeness and similarity, a senseless originality for fact. Rome was, we told the Irish, Boston is. Sort of the hard, tough reality of the way we feel about each other, or what connects us to each other, sort of in these bricks on the wall. I was always surprised where Robert Lowell ended up from where he began. That you might think you know where one of his poems is headed, and I think he's very good at thwarting expectations or throwing in. I think he had a good curveball and a good slider in the sort of way that Pedro Martinez does now.
Jim Brilley, the English and American reviewers are having a field day all over this Lowell comeback. What are the bloggers saying about Robert Lowell?
Well, I'm in a blog circle that wouldn't necessarily be reading Robert Lowell. I think they're more interested, I'm informed now by a tradition of people like Charles Olson. And Charles Olson famously said, if Robert Lowell is a poet, I don't want to be a poet. I think that's a little harsh.
What did he mean by that?
I think he was saying, well, that if that's poetry, then what I'm doing isn't poetry, and then I don't want to be part of it. He's part of a much projective verse is an opening of the field. It's an exploding of the page and trying to, that a poem can be sharing energy across a page rather than sharing meaning or moral value. I don't agree with that. I mean, I see Lowell as being And I think some of the most surprising people like Ron Silliman or Casey Mohammed, people who are terrific bloggers in my circle, have really come a long way to give Lowell some props. Well, they give Lowell a hard time, but they also come a long way and say, well, this is quite something, and that a book like this is very important. What it has done, in a lot of ways, is gotten Lowell back on the tips of people's tongues. This is a very big book, 1,000 pages, and it's a book you can't tiptoe around. It's work that has to be dealt with head on. There's a lot there, whether it's the turn of syntax or whether it's the way that crisp sounds come together in a line and then turn into another line that goes someplace even different. Just the way that you hear words that you wouldn't hear in poems. We've heard linguine today. We've heard BU. We've heard nigger. It seemed like there was nothing that he couldn't do. There was no word that he couldn't bring into it. But then, or there was no theme, no subject that was beyond him to write about, and to his own embarrassment or shame, or to speak to in these ways that were public that maybe had never been public.
Do you have a favorite among the mad poems?
I was very interested in his time at McLean and his sort of and madness in this way that I don't know what attracted me as a young poet. Oh, I thought maybe all poets were crazy. Or that maybe people like Lowell gave us the bravery to admit that we were crazy. This is called Art of the Possible from Day by Day. Your profession of making what can't be done the one thing you can do. In my parents' townhouse, a small skylight-covered courtyard, 6 feet by 9, lit 2 floors of bathrooms, their wanton windows, clear glass above and modestly glazed below. There for a winter or so, when 11 or 12, 1 year short of the catastrophic brink of adolescence, I nightly enjoyed my mother bathing, not lust, but the lust of the eye. We sit drinking and forking clams, a man and a woman 3 years younger, table companions for 20 years, raking over the roster of our acquaintance. Grateful our student hide, our trembling hand lift a fork in public. Father Freud brainwashed you to hate your mother. We stand to leave. Your breasts touch my chest. Under our clothes, our bodies are but as bodies are. On the thin ice of our hard age, malignant with surprises, everything inside us stings, yet chills, knowing the affliction of seduction. Tomorrow, the unbecoming oneness of our ravished body melts in the light of day. No engagement, I go. Darkness straightens the limping hand. Insomnia finds 100 justifications for the inexcusable phrase. After many lives in marriage, bedroom's blood temperature, my joy in making this room arctic, a solitary barrenness, finds the cold spots in the bed and cherishes their expiring chill.
What's the hook there for you?
I think in low voicing, what I think we can all relate to, something that's forbidden, but also something tender, that you're people you know, but whether it's your mother or whether it's a dinner companion, a certain slant of light, or that moment where you feel desire is spoken, and he's again speaking to something that maybe nobody had spoken to, and that now we can. It's funny to go back through these with you, just to hear them aloud, which I think is a wonderful thing to do, to read them aloud to yourself. So evocative of the time that I spent with these books. But also so much of the reasons that I became a poet, to try to find a rich voice, to try to make such wonderful sounds.
Jim Barely, thank you. Thanks for reading, and thanks for the testimony of a young poet about a poet I'm still trying to figure out.
Thank you, Chris. This was fun.